Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Joan Shelley Rubin. Rubin is a professor of history at the University of Rochester. She's the author of the highly regarded 1992 book, The Making of Middlebrow Culture. Her new book is called Songs of Ourselves, The Uses of Poetry in America. And this was published in April by the Harvard University Press. Thank you for joining us, Joan.
A pleasure.
Now, before we begin to talk about your current book, Songs of Ourselves, I want to touch on your statement that as a historian, you're interested in history for what it tells us about human experience. Talk to us a little about that.
Well, I'm a cultural historian, and of course, I think it's important that we learn about acts of Congress and presidential policies and battles of the Civil War. I know these are fascinating subjects to many people, but for me, the idea that, first of all, ordinary people make history as much as our leaders do, and secondly, that people are complicated. They have ambivalences. They have hopes and dreams and aspirations and also disappointments and muddled responses. These are the things that really interest me and what I wanted to recover about the past. So I got into this particular book.
Yeah, let's talk about it.
Because I was not alone in coming to the conclusion that looking at what people read and how they thought about what they read might give us some insight into those complicated features of human experience.
Mm-hmm. And especially history in this country is brought about by the people, supposedly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But tell us that story that that influenced this book as well, the influence of your father.
Right. Well, as I say in my introduction, there were two sort of streams that fed the ultimate decision to write this book. And one is the kind of scholarly interest that I just mentioned, because the history of reading has become we think it's a hot field. I don't know that everybody does, but it has become a recognized field, let's say, in the last few years. But the other source of the book was much more personal. As a cultural historian, I think I've always had an eye open for the revealing moment, something that says, hey, what's going on here? This is important to ordinary people. And that moment for me had to do with my father's discovery when he was in his 70s of the textbook, the English high school English textbook that he used growing up in outside of Rochester. And he found the book. Actually, I need to correct this because I have been informed quite recently since my book came out that it was really his sister, my aunt, who is still living, who found the book. So Aunt Connie, if you're listening, I want to give you credit for this.
And what was the name of the book?
The book is called Through Magic Casements. And she alerted my father to the fact that there were copies of this book around. And so then he went and discovered it in a Rochester area bookstore, a used copy of this textbook that, in fact, two high school teachers in the Rochester area had actually edited a poetry anthology that they then somehow got Macmillan, a nationally known publisher, to distribute. Mm-hmm. So the book had a wider life outside of upstate New York. But when my father rediscovered it, he was absolutely enchanted by the poems that he had memorized growing up, reciting in school, so enchanted that he began to make all of us his captive audience and start reciting them around the house. And the really telling moment for me was in these days before cell phones and free long distance, he picked up the phone and began to use precious long distance minutes reciting the poems to his sister who lived in California.
Oh, isn't that great? It brought back such memories.
Yeah. So I said, that's a moment
as
when
does
I said,
poetry,
you know,
in general.
What does this mean to him? What is going on here?
Now the book focuses on the period between 1880 and the mid 1950s. How did you come up with those particular periods of time?
Right. That is the main focus of the book, though I do frame it by going back to the early 19th century, and there are some moments in the book where I sneak ahead to the 1960s, and I even have a coda that talks a little bit about what's going on today. But I chose those dates because, on the one hand, by the 1880s and certainly the 1890s, the grand old men, and they were men, but the grand old men of American poetry, the so-called schoolroom poets like Henry Wadsworth Longfellow or William Cullen Bryant, those men were dying out. And people were worried about whether there would ever be any poets to replace them. And at this very moment, also, the realistic novel was really beginning to make its mark in the United States. And so I thought it's important to see whether poetry does decline, as people said it was doing at that time. It's important to see what goes on after the realistic novel breaks on the scene and after these great men disappear. So that was kind of the main start date. As far as ending in 1950, I have to say that that was mostly because I just couldn't do everything. I saw beat poetry looming on the horizon, and I said, I've got to stop. But it's also the moment when the school recitation begins to die out, not completely, but to a large extent, because teachers begin to believe that that kind of drill, that kind of rote learning, isn't a good way to learn.
Yeah, yeah. Now, let's go back to those early days of the late 19th century and the early 20th, when people were actually encountering poetry in public venues. Let's talk about that. That has died out pretty much.
Yes, though not completely. I think we can muster up the example of Robert Frost reading at the Kennedy inauguration.
I was going to bring that up, yep.
Or Maya Angelou at Bill Clinton's. But certainly you're right that we don't normally
have a poet to dedicate
a building now. And this is a practice that had a number of purposes and resonances for people who attended, say, a centennial commemoration, or, as you say, a kind of activity that might involve school children, like an Arbor Day celebration. And partly it was to dignify the occasion, to say, in effect, oh, this is a cultured place. And in fact, some locales that I looked at, and I used mainly upstate records for this part of my research, incidentally. So some locales like Cooperstown, of course, they have a big claim to fame in the history of authorship, and they trot out not only Cooper, but all sorts of other poets to celebrate when they have a centennial and so forth.
Now, you talk about how the interest in poetry was also used for the Americanization of immigrants.
Yes. So what I just mentioned, this kind of use at a commemorative event, is one kind of civic purpose that poetry was mustered for. But there, as we have an increasing immigrant population in the late 19th century and into the 20s. We sort of slammed the door on immigration in 1924, but there still are lots of immigrant non-native English speakers around in the 20s and even thereafter. There are some well-intentioned progressive educators and other reformers, YMCA officials, for example, who think that poetry would be a good way to teach the language and also to teach what they saw as American values.
I found that really interesting. I had never thought about that in regard to poetry.
And it's complicated. As I say, we could today stand back from all this and say, well, wait a minute, you know, they had their own cultural traditions, these immigrants. And in fact, some of these reformers come to poetry because they recognize that there is a poetic strain in the Eastern European, for example. Now, this still isn't free of the kind of prejudice we might detect there. And certainly the idea that there's one way to be an American is something that we're very suspicious of now. And yet, I do want to say, to the credit of these people, that there are other Americanizers, so-called, who don't think anybody should learn literature or poetry at all. Mm. They should just learn how to work in the factory.
Yeah, exactly. So poetry was actually being used as propaganda.
It was. According to some it was. People. And yeah. Of course, there are some fascinating paradoxes here. The British favorites like Tennyson or Alfred Noyes, these wind up being considered American. They wind up in, not literally,
but in American
poets, but they wind up in anthologies mm-hmm. that American citizens should memorize in order to become fully American themselves.
That's amazing. Yeah. Now poets in the early days were also considered seers and sages.
Mm-hmm.
So that really does feel like a different age, indeed, to me.
Yes and no. The idea that you would carry in your head lines of verse that you had memorized in school or you had recited within the family, that you would carry these as treasures that you could draw upon when you needed a bit of wisdom. This is the poet as the sage. And because I've had children in the public schools, I know we don't teach that officially anymore. And yet, when I did look at readers today and some of the responses that they wrote to Robert Pinsky, our former poet laureate, who did mm-hmm. a wonderful project collecting people's impressions and experiences with their favorite poems, their readers were saying, I turn to these lines, I turn to this poem when I'm in a crisis, when I need a bit of comfort. So there is the implicit idea mm-hmm. of the poetry as a sage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can understand the work as being provocatively inspiring, but I don't think we elevate poets
we don't,
these days.
In the, right. As, culturally, as we don't put them on that pedestal
yeah,
anymore.
Exactly. Now, let's go back to what you were talking about. People were afraid that the poetry was declining because of the realistic novels mm-hmm. rising. Talk to us about what the realistic novel was in those days.
The notion that a novel should portray life as it is. This is the doctrine that animates a figure such as William Dean Howells, who in the 1880s and 1890s in particular wrote sort of unsparing looks at the then relatively new urban environment or the labor conflicts of that period. And the corresponding moral lessons that our sort of guardians of taste in that period had thought literature should provide were still actually to some degree in place in a work such as Howells's novels, in works like Howells's novels. And he wasn't completely willing to just throw the moral baby out with the bathwater, mm-hmm. but still, it's much diminished. Whereas this poetry from the early and mid-19th century has moral lessons on the surface,
mm-hmm,
and that's
mm-hmm.
part of the reasons that it's part of the reason it lives, actually.
Mm-hmm. And compared to the realistic novel, I would think poetry in some ways was considered frivolous, some of it. You know, like flowery.
Or associated with women, yes.
Yeah.
I don't know that I would say frivolous as much as up above the nitty-gritty of life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Somewhat unfair charge, but, you know, these elevated sentiments.
Oh, I see.
Instead
uh-huh.
of really taking a close look at what's going on in, to take an example that people are pretty familiar with, Upton Sinclair's The Jungle,
yeah.
where the gruesome events of a meatpacking industry
yep.
are
yep.
displayed for all. You know, we don't have, until Carl Sandburg comes along, actually, and talks about the hog butchers of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And even then, it's not in that kind of bloody detail. You know.
that novel was quite shocking to
people right
at that point.
Right.
Now, let's focus on a poet that everyone has heard of, and that's Edna St. Vincent Millay.
Right. Oh, she's so interesting.
The epitome of the modern girl poet in her era.
I have to tell you that my students have not heard of her.
You're kidding me.
No, and that was a shock to me. So,
see, that
if you're
just,
out
that
there
to show
in your audience, in
but
your
it does
audience,
go to show you that people are not yeah. teaching poetry anymore.
Well,
there has
they're
been
not
a
reading those poets in this, and they're not reading them in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
But at any rate, yeah. What would you?
Yeah. Well, I'd like to talk about the fact that she was considered the modern girl poet in her era, and it's quite astonishing.
In multiple ways. I found this a really interesting piece of the book to work on, because on the one hand, if you know anything about Millay, you probably know that candle-burning line, my candle burns at both ends, and you think of her as the Greenwich Village gamine, the sexually advanced, risque figure that she was. But on the other hand, at this very moment when Millay earned that reputation, there were also literally girls. She was a bit older,
mm-hmm.
But there were literally mm-hmm. young girls who also became famous as kind of innocent, untutored genius poets. This is a kind of media phenomenon in a way in the 1920s. We don't know these figures. In particular, there's a girl called Hilda Conkling who has this reputation. Why were we, on the one hand, wanting young girls to have these qualities of innocence, and, I should say, attributing those same qualities in some settings to Millay herself?
Because her poetry was quite sophisticated.
Right. And, on the other hand, we're embracing her blatant sexuality, and there are readers who go out and want to be like her, you know, taking the ferry all night with their lovers and so forth. That told me about a tension in American culture around gender and sexuality.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And since Millay was bisexual, that adds to the tension all the more.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, my guest is Joan Shelley Rubin. She's a professor of history at the University of Rochester, and we're talking about her current book, Songs of Ourselves, The Uses of Poetry in America. We were just talking about Edna St. Vincent Millay and what a phenomenon she was. It's just like modern times, right? I mean, young women are sexualized.
Right.
And also then, being put down for not being innocent in the same breath.
At the same time.
Yeah.
We seem to want it both ways.
Now, let's talk about, you mentioned this just in passing, Robert Frost reading
yes.
poetry at the 1961 inauguration of John Kennedy.
Right.
That was quite a phenomenon.
Right.
And we haven't seen anything like that since, except for recently with Clinton having
yes.
Maya Angelou.
Yes, and of course Frost was very widely known and beloved, and so this was a very appropriate political choice for Kennedy,
mm-hmm. and it was a cultural event.
It was a signal, as I indicated earlier. It was a signal that he too, along with his wife, were cultured.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, and this was equally true, I think, in the late 19th century, it was good for poetry. It was a way of shoring up the cultural status of poetry. And Frost knew that. And actually, the poem that he had planned to read on that occasion, which was not the one that he actually recited, had lines in it about how this was good for the art and what a compliment it was to be there.
Yeah, and he was 86 years old at the time.
Yeah,
quite something
to
see him in his last years, I would assume.
Yes.
Now another subject you touch on is the example of the emotional link of the public with living poets, and you talked about Carl Sandburg.
Yeah,
that was quite an interesting chapter to me.
Right. Well, much of the research for this book depended on the letters of ordinary people. And in the case of Sandburg, here was a poet who saved all of the fan mail that he got, or at least it looked like all of it to me. There were certainly mountains of it in the library at the University of Illinois where it's housed. And so I waded into this fan mail and was quite touched by the emotional tenor of these letters from readers who wrote to Sandburg not only as a friend, not only, that is, thinking that they were his friend, but with the presumption that he understood them and that he was their friend. And part of this, of course, was because Sandburg did make such an effort to write about not only the hog butchers of the world, but the people, mm-hmm. yes, as is the title of one of his books. Mm-hmm. So some of the letters would say, I am the people you have written about, and I know that you appreciate my struggles in life. And Sandburg wrote back in language that honored this perception, and we could say, by saying, yes, I will treasure your letter, or I like the sound of your voice, I like the tone you use, to say something personal to the reader. But as you might imagine, and I'm not really criticizing him for this because he had all of these mountains of mail, these were form letters.
Yeah, that shocked me.
These were form letters. And the readers who then received one and wrote back or received an autographed book and wrote to thank him never set aside any cynicism about this, if they ever had an inkling of cynicism. They just wrote back and said, I know you love me. And I love you. And this is an example of a relationship, then. A personal, and in this case, an emotion-laden relationship. A social relationship.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Here between a real reader and a real poet. But sometimes enacted between readers and poets just on paper, or just in the reader's thinking or in their hearts. It's a way, though, that poetry is social, in addition to the civic uses that mm-hmm. we've talked about. Mm-hmm.
Goes to show you that there's a thread running through American culture, probably every culture, of people who are extremely lonely.
Oh, yes. The most painful of these letters were the ones that said, I'm all alone mm-hmm. except for you. And I write also about the poet and the essayist and the naturalist John Burroughs, mm-hmm. who was so important to the early conservation movement. And he, too, got letters in response to, in particular, one early poem that he wrote called Waiting, in which he essentially said, don't worry, things are going to turn out okay in the end. Painful, poignant letters from people who essentially said, I've been waiting, and yeah, I'm lonely, but you understand me.
Oh, I find that quite sad, obviously, but it's something that hasn't changed.
Right.
People now think of movie stars and cultural phenomenons as their best friends.
Right.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the 50s and Allen Ginsberg and some of those poets that you just start touching on.
Right.
Because it seems to me that's during the transitional time when people were starting to write more personal poetry.
Well, I think that we begin to see then what is quite characteristic of the situation of poetry today. In fact, I've heard someone say that the reason that we are in this poetry revival today in terms of poetry slams and other events is because of the coffee. It's because of the coffee. We had the Beat Coffee House, and then we had this coffee revival. Now we have poetry. I don't know if that's true or not. But more seriously, I think it's the overlap between the poetry reader and the poetry writer that begins to occur in that period. Of course, the introduction of free verse makes this possible. Poets who hear me say this are probably cringing because they know that free verse is difficult to write, and it isn't just any
string
bunch
of
words strung together. But there was, of course, a perception that it was, on the part of some people, that it was easier. And there are outpourings from people who are readers but also writers. And I think today that overlap is almost total, so that there aren't a lot of people who read poetry regularly who aren't also trying their hand at it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And are you fond of the way poetry has transitioned in this culture with rap and poetry slams and And then the way it's being used publicly for many different reasons.
Well, this has become a bit controversial of late, especially now that the Poetry Foundation has an enormous amount of money, thanks to the Lilly bequest, mm-hmm. to support public programming having to do with poetry. And also the National Endowment for the Arts has revived recitation contests in the high school. I think most of that is a good thing. How can it be a bad thing that people are reading and writing? I know that, well, let me say this. Poetry isn't just one thing, one entity.
Oh, absolutely.
There are different kinds of poetry. And there's always going to be a place in our culture and should be, we must have a place in our culture from what we might call the rarefied sensibility or the avant-garde poet. And those people are going to write poems that are not accessible to ordinary readers mm-hmm. in the way that some of the things the Poetry Foundation and others are supporting are accessible. But so what? Mm-hmm. They're not the our sort of high culture poets, I don't think, are being hurt by this other activity. And in the meantime, I think it's good for people.
Oh, I do too. Any kind of communication, I think, is great in this culture. Mm-hmm. We only have about a minute left. How has poetry touched your life personally?
Well, I was thinking about that and thinking about how I resemble the readers I write about. Because for me, my favorite poems, my well-loved poems, are the ones that I learned in college. And the readers I write about, I argue in this book that the meanings that people make out of poems are inseparable from the sites at which they are learning them or speaking them or remembering them. So for me, the fact that I was in college in those heady days of the late 60s, learning about modernism, learning T.S. Eliot, that's all connected to seeing the world with new eyes.
Mm-hmm. Well, Joan, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure talking to you about this wonderful subject, which I am totally fond of. So thank you so much.
I'm delighted to have done this. Thanks.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes in Corning, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.